We find documented accounts within many ancient civilizations referencing beings from the stars, such as the Epic of Gilgamesh, where we learn of the Anunnaki, the Egyptian mythology of deities and sky gods, the Indian gods who came to Earth in flying machines known as Vimanas. Author and researcher Paul Wallace probes the world's ancient mythologies for clues about the origins of the human race. He believes that the Bible is full of contact with extraterrestrials.
If I ask people, are you aware that the current version of Genesis isn't the original? Yes, they'll say. Are you aware that the word Elohim behaves like a plural? Yes, they'll say. Have you ever wondered why it says, let us make so on and so forth, why these plural behaviors exhibit? Yes, they'll say. Are you aware that these stories are based on the Sumerian stories? Yes, they'll say. Do you know the Sumerian stories are about sky people who come from another planet? Probably. And then that's where it'll stop. Because the next thing they'll say is, I just haven't put much thought to it. And I don't say that as some damning criticism, because that was me as well. I hadn't put much thought to it until I actually had the time to sit down when I wasn't under the pressure of trying to produce a coherent sermon by Sunday morning, and could actually probe things a little bit further. It was only then that I thought a bit further and realized, wait a minute, I'm missing something really important here. And once you do make that connection, once you realize that at root we've got these accounts of humanity's interaction with another species, it's like taking the red pill in the Matrix. You can't go back.
Paul has published several books in the field of mysticism and spirituality. In the last decade, his work has probed the world's ancient mythologies for the insights they hold on our origins as a species and our potential as human beings.
The idea that human beings were engineered up to this level, and up to a level a little bit superior to where we are now, where we could do things like remote view, where we had things like precognition, or where we could exercise powers of healing, those kinds of things, this higher level of consciousness. And so many of the mythologies say we had that, and then those were turned down, or inhibitors were put in our brains to switch those off. And there's a phenomenon called acquired savant syndrome, which I mentioned to you before, which is where by accident higher capacities get switched on in people's brains. So there's a guy who lived down the road from me in Victoria who had a car crash, was in a coma for 3 days. And when he emerged from that, he could speak fluent Mandarin. And he'd learned Mandarin at school, but he'd never been fluent in it. And he called to the nurse. He said, I'm in pain. Can you prop me up a bit? And it came out in Mandarin. He was a bit perplexed, not knowing what was going on. He thought, I better write a note. So he wrote a note. It came out in Mandarin. Well, fortunately, his Australian English did return to him, but his Mandarin stayed. And he went on to host a game show in China and then to go on and study at university in China. There's another guy, quite well-known, Orlando Sorrell, who was hit in the head by a baseball when he was 10 years old, and it unlocked phenomenal mathematical skills. And you hear stories of phenomenal memory, artistic skills, and ability with a musical instrument. Things that suddenly get switched on by an injury. Now, we do have neuroscientists who are studying this, but they can't explain it. It's completely counterintuitive. How can an injury extend somebody's abilities? It should diminish them. But it's saying, no, there are inhibitors in the brain that have got knocked off, and now this ability has been released. Science can't explain that, but all the mythologies have this storyline that makes sense of that and that say, actually, we all have those capabilities. And it's a matter of, can we switch them back on? And it seems to me that in the spiritual traditions and shamanic traditions, mystical traditions of the world, we've always had people whose work has been trying to switch those inhibitors off and operating at this higher level of consciousness. And a lot of people have glimpses of these things, a little glimpse of precognition, a little glimpse of remote viewing, enough for me to think, what would it be like if we could operate at this level rather than this? What would it do, not just for me as an individual, It'd be great to have superpowers, but what would it do to us as a society if we were that much more conscious? And that's one of the exciting so what's that comes from the if we were engineered by ETs, as the mythologies say.
Paul's work in church ministry has included training pastors in the interpretation of biblical texts, working as a troubleshooter for communities of faith, and serving as an archdeacon in the Anglican Church in Australia. His background as a senior churchman makes it all the more surprising that Paul's latest book argues that human origins lie in our prehistoric contact with extraterrestrial species.
The background of the book, which is this one here, Escaping from Eden, is really in, has a couple of start points, really. And one is when I was 11 years old and I first encountered Eric von Daniken. And he was being discussed at a dinner party hosted by my mum and dad. And I liked what I was hearing because I've been going to a church school, Church of England school, and I've been a bit put off by how I'd seen the school use religion to control us. And I remember thinking that as a five-year-old kid and thinking, this is only for the weak-minded. I'm not buying into this. And that was my bias, really, towards what I'd seen of the Christian faith and its explanations of our beginnings. And those questions always fascinated me. So when I heard an alternative explanation from Eric von Daniken, my ears pricked up. And it made sense to me that there was something missing in the story of how we came to be a conscious, intelligent, technological species. And Eric von Daniken seemed to have identified some evidences suggesting that there'd been input from another intelligence. And that made sense to me. And so I followed that for a while, but I didn't notice at first that it hadn't answered some of my ultimate questions of where we all came from. It had just moved the question to another planet. And in a funny way, all my questioning led me from there to becoming a Christian. And it was a little while before I noticed that my Christian faith hadn't answered all the questions Eric von Daniken had raised in his book. But by now I was getting busy with life and work, and I went into ministry, working in the church scene for about 30 years. And I just didn't have time to get back to some of these unresolved questions that Eric von Daniken had raised. And, you know, how life gets, you are just so busy making a living, you don't have the leisure to go off on and study things that are of interest to you just for the sake of it. And so it wasn't until I suffered an ultimate frisbee injury that I had the time to do that. And the moment I sat down and started drilling down into some of the anomalies in the Christian story, the conventional reading of Genesis, that I began to see another story emerging. And took some time to follow that. And I worked out bit by bit that the anomalies in that story, the anomalies in the book of Genesis, are really the vestiges of a much older story, the stories on which Genesis is based. And they turn out to be the portals to a rather more interesting world.
One famous encounter is reported in the book of Ezekiel in the Old Testament. Ezekiel describes an encounter with beings in a flying machine. The passage reads, "I looked and I saw a windstorm coming out of the north, an immense cloud with flashing lightning and surrounded by brilliant light. The center of the fire looked like glowing metal, and in the fire was what looked like four living creatures. In appearance, their form was human, but each of them had four faces and four wings. Spread out above the heads of living creatures was what looked like something like a vault, sparkling like crystal and awesome. Under the vault, their wings were stretched out, one toward the other, and each had two wings covering its body. When the creatures moved, I heard the sound of their wings, like the roar of rushing waters, like the voice of the Almighty." Paul believes that what Ezekiel describes is a close encounter with a technologically advanced being.
Ezekiel doesn't present it as a vision. He tells us where he was when this happened, where he got taken and where he got dropped off and what state he was in when he was dropped off. He doesn't say it's a vision. And you've only got to read the details of the story to realize that some kind of vehicle is being described to you. You can't reason that away. And it's funny because when Ezekiel gets picked up in this craft and he gets taken around various cities in what's now Iraq, the person flying the craft is trying to have conversations with him about religion and politics. But Ezekiel's distracted. He can't really pay attention to that because he's looking around thinking, how is this working? What's making that noise that sounds like a waterfall behind us? How do these wheels work? And all the time, he is absolutely perplexed by the craft that's carrying him around. Now, that's how he describes it. It seems a bit silly for us to say we know better than he did what happened and it must be a vision. The story is one I really love because there was a fellow called Joseph Blumrich, who, I don't know if you know this story, heard Eric von Daniken talking about the Ezekiel passage with this flying craft. And it was a speech that Eric von Daniken gave at NASA, if I remember correctly. And Blumrich was a senior engineer for NASA at the time. I think this was about 1972. And he went to Eric von Daniken after the talk and said, I think you're reading the wrong book for technological details. He said, the Bible is really a spiritual book. You're not going to find technology in it. And Eric von Daniken said, just go away and read the Ezekiel story and then come back and we'll talk again. So Blumrich went away and was really shocked when he sat down with the text. And he brought an engineer's mind to it. He listened to the descriptions of the vehicle, and he thought, what would happen if I draw schematics of what's being described? And what happened as a result of that was so coherent and so credible that his opinion completely flipped around, and he published a book called The Spacecrafts of Ezekiel and came to the view that that was exactly what we were looking at, and he really nailed his colors to the mast while he was working at NASA, while he had this senior project development position. And I can see why that would happen. I just cannot see how you can escape that you're reading the story of a craft that's flying this guy around Iraq.
What do you think it was that led you to question some of the meanings and interpretations within biblical scripture? Were there any specific passages or anomalies that first caught your attention?
Well, some of the anomalies are really very obvious, and they're the kind of questions any child asks when you sit down and you try and read the Genesis stories to them. So a child would ask, why does God say, let us make in our image? Why does God say we don't want the human beings to become like us, or now they've become like us, or let us go and see? And if you have kids, and even if you're reading a children's Bible, they'll ask those questions. Or you get to the story of the fall. Why did God make that snake? Why couldn't he see something was going to go wrong? Or why was he so cruel and vicious in his response in the fall, or with the flood, or with the Tower of Babel? And these really are anomalies. Any preacher knows that it's very difficult to draw a positive moral from those stories. And so you have to ask, well, what are they there for? What is that text there for? So those are some, but the one that really took me into ET territory was the anomaly of one of the words used for God. Now, the current version of Genesis uses two key words, two root words for God. And one is Yahweh, and that's the holy name of God given to Moses. And then there's an older word, Elohim. And scholars generally agree that the current form of Genesis took shape in the 6th century BC, and that the editor use the holy name of God to tie all the stories together that the people of Israel had carried for centuries and centuries. And so we see the holy name of God appearing centuries before it was revealed. And he's done it to tie them all together. And he does it in such a way that the reader knows they're not reading the original version of the stories. They've been edited. The name Yahweh has been put in. So as soon as you ask the question, what were the original stories? Why did they have to be changed? What was wrong with them that they needed an edit? And what's the meaning of this earlier word, Elohim? That's what really gets you going on the journey. The word Elohim is really curious because it's a plural word. It's a plural Hebrew word. And it's odd that a plural word gets translated as God. What happens if you read it as a plural? Now, I know some scholars say, oh, it just looks like a plural. But God's really the proper translation of it. Context makes that clear. But it doesn't just look like a plural. It often takes plural verbs, exhibits plural behaviors, plural moralities, plural agendas. And so ultimately, if something looks like a duck, swims like a duck, quacks like a duck, you should consider whether it might be a duck. What happens if you read it as a plural? And what happens is not a random thing. This is what I did when I was taken out by my injury, sitting in my shipping crate cabin, going through the texts and thinking, what have I missed? Because I know I'm scratching around on the surface here. As soon as you read the Genesis stories with Elohim as a plural, and the word etymologically just means the powers or the powerful ones, if you read it that way, you realize you're reading the Sumerian stories, that they just flip like that, and you're reading a summary form of the Sumerian stories, which shouldn't be a surprise, because Abraham and Sarah, the progenitors of Judaism, came out of a Sumerian culture. They came from Mesopotamia. They carried their creation mythologies with them, and the stories they brought with them were the stories of the powerful ones. When you realize that what you're reading is a summary of the Sumerian texts, it throws up a massive question. The Sumerian texts, and they overlap in an amazing way. All the familiar stories of Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, the fall, abductions and interbreeding, the flood that comes as a punishment, the Tower of Babel, all those stories appear in the Sumerian panoply. But the Sumerians and Babylonians don't tell those as God stories. They're the stories of the sky people. And the word they use is it's a glyph that indicates the sky. And sky people is really the most basic way of translating it. And you watch the behavior of them, and clearly that's what you're looking at, sky people, not God. And as you follow the Sumerian story, detail after detail adds up to the conclusion that the sky people are people from the sky, from another planet, and that these are the recollections of humanity's interaction with another technologically superior, more powerful species in our prehistoric past. And that is where the Genesis stories come from.
Many similarities exist between biblical stories and other mythological accounts, in particular the Sumerian and Babylonian accounts. At an academic level, many scholars affirm that the biblical stories are probably based on the Sumerian legends. Is that view accepted outside of academic circles, or does it conflict with traditional faith?
You've got churches full of pastors who know that Genesis is based on the Sumerian texts, but congregations who've never heard this. And so there's an awful lot of catching up that the general public have to make, or people in congregations have to make, which is a little bit unfair. Because I think these are things we should be talking about. The mysteries of the text are fascinating, are exciting. We want to drill down into the truth of things. But unfortunately, often if you have churches that operate with a 10-minute sermon on a Sunday morning, you're not going to get there. And so that's why I think some people respond with a bit of a knee-jerk reaction with some less thought-through ideas. Oh, this must be Trinitarian. It must just Trinitarianism. It must just look like a plural. All that sort of thing, because they really haven't had time to take on board some of the facts that are really quite widely known. The ancient mythologies that we have are so rich and so full of memory and information, and we often really dumb down what's in them by not taking the time with them. People get scared that if you sort of pick it apart too much, it loses its magic somehow, that you're being disrespectful to the text or something along those lines, that it's impious or disrespectful to be probing the scriptures that way. But that's not the case at all. They have been crafted so carefully to carry ancient memory, and it's up to us to actually plumb that.
Many ancient stories have been considered mythological, deemed folklores and tales consisting of narratives to inlay a moral message. Do you think this is the case, or could many of these mythologies be true accounts that have been mistranslated through the ages?
Well, this is often the dichotomy that people bring to mythologies. They either read them as fables, or they want to read them as fables or moral tales, because I think you'll find some stories and you'll think, oh, that's, I can make sense of that. I can find a moral in that story. And then you go to another one and you're going to have to do some contortions to try and get something positive out of that. I think that's why there's the inconsistency. But there are those who try and read the mythologies in a fundamentalist kind of way, where word by word, letter by letter, that's history, that's science, that's exactly what happened. My reading of the mythologies changed when I started comparing the stories from culture to culture, because these stories of the sky people that I mentioned earlier repeat in mythologies all around the world. And some of those main stories about the engineering of humankind and the details of those stories repeat in mythology after mythology. And once you've seen enough of that repetition, between cultures who've had no contact with each other, you begin to realize that there must be some fount of memory that is being carried by these stories. And so that's how I see it. I don't read them in a fundamentalist way, but I do believe that these indigenous cultures crafted these mythologies as their vehicle for collective memory. That's why they produced them. That's why they took such care. And that's why the same stories keep repeating from cultures that had no contact with each other.
Was it quite a shock to you when researching the various ET interpretations found within ancient writings?
But there were so many moments when I was writing the book where I had to say, in the words of James Brown, wait a minute, because of what I was seeing, what was recurring, and what I was remembering from my earlier studies. Because this view, this understanding that there were other entities involved in shaping Homo sapiens, was a view that was put forward 2,500 years ago by Plato. And Plato is just, everyone should read Plato. He is amazing. So much of his writing, I love how he approaches things. It's just logic applied to what we've observed. And then he reaches these amazing, far-reaching conclusions. And then alongside those, he talks about knowledge that he has obtained from ancient sources. And he put forward the idea that we are not alone in the universe, that there are other kinds of beings. And he talks about beings who live on, and his phrase was, islands in the sky. Mm-hmm. And they're more intelligent than us. They live longer than we do. They have more technology than we do, and their understanding of space is far more advanced than ours. That was one of his beliefs. And then he also put forward the idea that he believed in a creator God, a God who's the source of all things, but he also believed that there were other entities that had been involved in nurturing sentient, conscious, intelligent life, in particular us. And he called those entities children of God. And another word he used was a demiurge, or a craftsman who crafted what we know of the solar system and our planet, so on and so forth. Now, if it was just Plato who said that, you'd think, oh, well, those are colorful, interesting ideas. But the fact of the matter is that right at the beginning of the Christian faith, there were significant leaders, significant church fathers who agreed with Plato's explanation of beginnings. And they believed that what he had said was a better explanation of the Elohim stories in the Bible. They didn't see any conflict between the two. And so this discussion of other species and their involvement in our beginnings was part of the mainstream conversation in the early church. And it remained that for the first 140 years or so. And then some people lost some debates and got excommunicated. And that whole idea went taboo. And Christianity decided to just glue on the mainstream Jewish view of things, which is one God, one creator of all, no other beings, no ET family, we're alone in the universe. And that was the orthodox accepted view between 140 AD and 2009, when, to my surprise, Pope Benedict XVI put all those questions that Plato had raised back on the table and saying, we need to be thinking about these things.
In what way did Pope Benedict XVI do this?
Well, what happened in 2009, this was another thing that had just sat with me for a decade or so and made me think I need to go back and look at some questions in the Bible, because Benedict XVI was the absolute picture of orthodoxy and conservatism. He was the most conservative pope, certainly in my lifetime. So I was really blown away when, out of the blue, in 2009, he calls on the Pontifical Academy of Sciences to convene a colloquium. And what that meant was 5 days of closed sessions, 30 top scholars and theologians, and they published what they were going to be talking about. They wanted everybody to know. They were going to be talking about the theological implications of contact with another civilization. I thought, what? Where's this coming from? I mean, it wasn't that long ago they were burning people at the stake for just suggesting there might be intelligent life on other planets, let alone having contact with them. And there was quite a long lead into this colloquium. For about a year, Father José Gabriel Funes, who's the director of the Vatican Observatory, had been going to the press and saying things like, we need to be ready to embrace a brother or sister alien sooner than anyone anticipates, was the phrase he kept using. And I thought, what? Sooner? What do they know? Because it really gave the impression that they're wanting to get in ahead of some other disclosure being made by another authority. Well, the colloquium came and happened. And then they went to the press, and senior spokespeople went on the TV and did interviews. And what they said was this: first of all, we should be ready to embrace a brother or sister alien. We shouldn't be shocked by them, because they would just be creatures of the same creator. There's no theological issue. And then Monsignor Corrado Balducci, who was the top exorcist for the Vatican, went a little bit further. And he said, when people talk about encounters with ETs, they are not reporting a psychological episode. And it's not a demonic issue either. They have had an encounter with a totally different kind of entity that deserves serious study. And I was amazed when I heard that, because he really had, in that statement, affirmed the existence of other entities, not demonic, not psychological, but essentially ETs. And then Reverend Dr. Guy Consolmagno, they've all got these wonderful names, came out with a statement saying, not only should we be ready to embrace a brother or sister alien, we shouldn't call them aliens, because we're clearly part of the same family, and we shouldn't be surprised to meet them, because they're in the Bible. They're in the New Testament and the Old Testament. And when he said that, I thought, wait a minute. I've been preaching from the Bible for 30 years. I've been lecturing courses on how to interpret the Bible for 15 years. What have I missed? How have I missed that there are aliens in the New Testament and Old Testament? And so when I had the time, I just followed some of the leads that he'd given. Now, a lot of believers would say, oh, I think I know what he's talking about. There's this moment in Genesis 6 that looks like alien abductions. It looks like an interbreeding with another species, because there's this interbreeding, and what results is the giants, the men of legend. And that's a mythology that repeats in mythologies all around the world. It must be that. But when I went back and started looking at the Elohim word, I realized that the story of ET contact begins from the very first verse of the Bible, and the ET presence doesn't disappear from the Bible until you're in the last book of the Bible.
Are there multiple types of ETs documented within our ancient history? If so, do they come with positive or negative agendas for the human race?
Well, that's a great question, because starting with the Bible, there seem to be different factions who are in conflict with each other. There's a body called the Heavenly Council or the Divine Council, and they're often in conflict. And the conflicts seem to be around human beings, how conscious we should be, how intelligent, how technological. And those conflicts play out in mythologies all around the world. When you go further into the story of the Old Testament, it does look like you've got communities of people that either are hosting or are being ruled over by some other kind of entity. And they're in conflict with each other. They'll send the human beings to war against each other so that one powerful one can get more stuff than the other powerful one. And so there are some hints there that there might be more than one kind of ET presence being represented in the story. And certainly there are groups that are not working in harmony with each other. So it's intriguing. It's not absolutely spelled out. But by my reading of the story, I think we are talking about more than one kind of entity interacting in our prehistoric past. But I'd just like to pick up on what you were saying about positive and negative agendas, because there has been some repetition of the idea that we were created as a slave species and were just dominated by these horrible ETs who turn up. I actually think that may be part of the story, that we were a workforce for other people from other planets who came and colonized planet Earth for a while. But there are some lovely positive things, positive agendas that come out in the mythologies as well. My reading of the so-called creation account in Genesis, now having taken the red pill, is that what we are reading is the recollection of a planetary recovery, and of people arriving from another planet to help nurture planet Earth back into life and to help nurture sentient life back into being. And there are some clues in the text that that's what's happened, because before any word of creation is spoken, before let there be light, planet Earth already exists, and it's flooded and it's shrouded in darkness. It's in a state, the Hebrew phrase means it's been devastated. It's in a state of chaos. And what we read about really looks like people turning up to help the planet recover post-cataclysm. And I do think that's what we're reading about. So that's a very positive agenda. They're doing for us what we do for one another when we go into countries after natural disasters. And another lovely positive note that I find is there's a fascinating moment from about 10,000 years ago when we see farming suddenly emerge on planet Earth. Suddenly there are crops being cultivated and there's animal husbandry going on. And it's fascinating how it appears, because it appears very locally at a place called Karakadag in Turkey. And the researchers who made the discovery said it looks like it may even have been one family who was shown how to do this. A genetic modification of the crops, something else with the animals, all of a sudden we've got farming, and now it's in India, now it's in Greece, and it just springs up all around the planet. And in the mythologies, the explanation for that is that that was something taught to us by another intelligence, by another species. And in one of the African mythologies, there's a female entity called Mbabwana Warisa, who teaches farming and beer making. And then you go to Sumeria and they're taught farming and beer making. And you go to Mesoamerica and they're taught farming and beer making. And I think, what nicer thing could an ET do than come and teach human beings how to make beer? and enjoy life. I just think that's such a nicer picture than this alien invasion that takes over and then runs us as worker bees. But they may all be part of the picture.
What do you think are some of the reasons that ETs would be coming to our planet?
You know, if people ask, why would ETs bother coming here? I just think it's interesting to look at how we've colonized other countries and enjoyed sitting at the top of the economic tree. And then we withdraw, but through trade agreements, pricing of natural resources, we're actually still in the mix. I wonder how much of what we've seen on planet Earth actually does play out on an interplanetary level, because there are so many hints that people came here from another planet for some kind of economic advantage. And I think there are serious evidences that planet Earth was mined in the prehistoric past, and possibly not by us.
If the Earth has indeed been visited by beings from another planet, would the public's knowledge of this information make any difference to how we currently live?
It's a great question. After I'd completed my research for Escaping from Eden, where that took me was to the question, what difference does it make? You know, my book asked the question, were we created by God or engineered by ETs? What difference does it make? And I think there are a couple of differences that it makes. And one is to do with who we are and what our potential is as human beings. Whether we carry on living the same kinds of lives or if we believe that something quite different is possible for us, I think the ET narrative opens all that up. But the other question I had was, what if that colloquium happened because the Vatican was expecting a disclosure? What if a disclosure then was made? You know, what if the Chinese go to the moon and bring back photographs of technological structures there? What if all of a sudden we are told, actually, we've been in contact for the last 70 years? What would happen? And I don't believe that there would be mass panic, because if we've been in contact for the last 70 years, then it looks like we're in a fairly stable situation. But I think where the chaos might come from is the question of, how do I feel living in a world where aspects of our government have had this information and have chosen not to tell us? How do I feel about authorities? How do I feel about government if we've been managed to that extent? And I think that might be the more random, less predictable element of the whole story of disclosure.
If we have been modified by extraterrestrials at some point in time, would they have built restrictions within us that we can potentially overcome?
It interests me that if you want to find scientific support for the idea of ET engineering, DNA research is probably the best place you can go, because there are significant leaders in that whole field who are very open in saying, we believe that our DNA has been intelligently designed by an extraterrestrial intelligence. And you've got, if I can think of some names, Vladimir Scherbak, Maxim Okulov of the Fezenkov Institute, Francis Crick, who was one of the two who discovered the double helix structure of DNA, Leslie Orgel, who's a top physicist. And they all put forward the idea that our coding came to planet Earth from somewhere else, from outer space. And the idea that's most broadly put forward is the idea called panspermia, which is where genetic coding for conscious, intelligent life has been disseminated through the galaxy. And when it arrives on a hospitable planet, what Star Trek called a Class M planet, it results in forms of life like us. And one of the clues for intelligent design that Scherbak and Okulov point to, and they are really top people in the field of DNA research, is this repetition of prime numbers. And that really amused me when I heard that, because have you seen the movie Contact by Carl Sagan? Because the clue in Contact that a message had been sent by an intelligent species from elsewhere was these repetition of primes. And they were saying that can't occur naturally. And what Sherbach and Markulov are saying is that that has happened. That broadcast has been sent. Those repetitions of primes can be seen, but it's not in a radio signal. It's in our DNA genetic code. And they say it's almost like the creator's signature has been put in there. And of course, the question is whose signature is that? But they are in no doubt that it is not random and that that signature has been put there by an intelligence.
Was it surprising to you what the scriptures uncovered during your research into the Genesis accounts?
When I sat down to write a book about Genesis, I didn't expect it to really end up with ETs. I've been wanting to write a book on Genesis for a long time because I knew there was some layers there that I was missing and I wanted to dig into it a bit. But the exploration took me onto some territory that was surprising to me.
Thanks for watching The Fifth Kind. You can find out more information and links to Paul Wallace in the description below, along with links to his published works. Go to www.paulanthonywallace.com for information about Paul and his books. Escaping from Eden, does Genesis teach that the human race was created by God or engineered by ETs? Is available for pre-order from January 2020, hitting the shelves in April, and can be found at Axis Mundi Books or on Amazon or anywhere that books are sold. You can find Paul on the Paul Wallace channel on YouTube, also linked below.